The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis, and WYSO Weekend is on hiatus this week. We're going to bring you a special one-hour edition of the Book Nook on your Sunday morning. And coming up, we're going to be talking to Jonathan Lethem. He is a co-editor of Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z, recently published by the Library of America. He and Kevin Detmar were the editors, and this is a collection of great rock and roll criticism coming up right after NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Jonathan Lethem. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Jonathan, I absolutely loved this new collection that you and Kevin Detmar have put together for the Library of America. It's called Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. How did this project get underway? How did this happen?
Well, so it does have an origin story, and it's a kind of a long one. I got to know Kevin when he asked me to write a chapter on a Bob Dylan album, one of those ignominious Bob Dylan albums from the 80s, for his anthology, A Cambridge Guide to Bob Dylan, or Cambridge Companion to Bob Dylan. So I wrote a chapter about an album called Infidels. And shortly after that, I was hired by Pomona College and joined Kevin here in the English department, which is where I'm sitting while we talk, and learned that he was teaching a course on rock writing in the English department, and that was terrifically interesting to me. And we got talking, and we became closer and closer friends. And one day he said to me that he'd been thinking about the need in the classroom for a really good scholarly, authoritative anthology of the, canonical rock critics. And that got us going. And I already had some connection with the Library of America. I'd edited the Philip K. Dick novels for them. And, from my time in New York City, I knew Jeffrey O'Brien and Max Rudin, who were the two guys in the office there who worked with us closely on this anthology. And so it sort of emerged from a conversation with between me and Kevin, and quickly grew to include Jeffrey and Max. And that was about 5 years ago now. So the contents page was very slow in the evolution, but we're very proud of the book.
And the book is Shake It Up, and these pieces that you chose appear in chronological order, mostly, except for maybe the Prince piece, which you really couldn't do that way. But you started off with a guy who I had the pleasure of having on the program about 20 years ago, and I think of him as Mr. Liner Note, Nat Hentoff. What a guy.
Yeah. Oh, I grew up reading Hentoff as the house jazz critic in the Village Voice, so that was how I first knew his name and didn't realize the breadth of his other accomplishments. And there are novels, and he really did the first canonical and most important interview with Bob Dylan early on, and wrote so many great liner notes. So it was a natural place for the book to begin.
I loved rereading those liner notes from the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, his second album, because the things that Dylan says, I know that you're someone who has studied Dylan intensely. it's so wonderful to hear how fresh he sounds.
Yeah, it's really true. And Hentoff mostly just, captures the sound of the moment, which is a time when, Dylan and some other people were basically, inventing the music vernacular, the landscape that we have lived in ever since. It was such a time of inventions. And so it's a real snapshot.
I have so many favorites in here, and I have to admit that even though I've read widely in this type of writing, I had not read most of these, and some of them are really eye-openers, including the one by Jules Siegel called Goodbye Surfing, Hello God, where
That's
we're seeing
an amazing piece, isn't it? Yeah.
We're seeing Brian Wilson just kind of fall apart before our eyes. The Beach Boys were at the crest of the wave. They were buying themselves Rolls Royces, and here's Brian at home in his sandbox.
Yeah, living in a sandbox in his living room. And, what's amazing is how accessible so much of that world was. You know, the writers in those early days are just walking right in and getting these undefended, unprotected, interviews with the most important inventors of the 60s counterculture, and it would never be that way again. You know, nothing was being managed. Nothing was there weren't publicists standing in the room.
I grew up in high school reading Rolling Stone, but I tended to like the British mags because I was into the British progressive rock, as we called it back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I loved Melody Maker, and then I kind of shifted in the New Musical Express. So I kind of missed out on a lot of this writing. And I'd always heard that Crawdaddy was an incredible magazine, but I didn't read it. And then I read your piece by Paul Williams called Outlaw Blues. And I love the fact that he's such a fan. He's talking about the Rolling Stones and how, I didn't like this album. And then I decided I liked it. And then I decided, they can't do a bad song. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's so intense.
Well, that captures exactly what was remarkable about Paul Williams' writing. I'm going to refer to him as Paul because he was actually a pretty good friend of mine, which was a piece of luck for me as a very young writer. I got to tag along with him into a lot of interesting situations. But he never quit being a fan, and he writes in this kind of breathless, thinking aloud, first thought, best thought style, which, is not for everyone. It's certainly not as polished or it doesn't convey the authority of a kind of a scholarly essay, which is something you see the advent of is, self-consciously serious writing about rock and roll. But at the same time, it isn't ephemeral. He's writing about it as if it's the most important thing that ever happened to him and as if it's changing the world. But he's recording his thoughts in real time, and he's never embarrassed to change his mind, as you say, or to include, digressive thoughts or even gossip, slips in between the lines. And so it's another piece of writing in this anthology that I think is like a time machine. You just open it up and you dial right back into a very, very different world.
My guest is Jonathan Lethem. We're talking about Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. He edited it along with Kevin Detmar for the Library of America. And in that same piece, he talks a lot about Jefferson Airplane. And we are here at Antioch College. We're the Antioch College radio station. And for a brief period, a guy named Jorma Kaukonen went to Antioch. He didn't stick around. But
I didn't know that. That's funny.
And it's so great to read about him in that essay and to look at the music and to hear that music again. And the next essay by Stanley Booth, The Memphis Soul Sound. Wow, that is another knockout.
Booth is a terrific writer. And, he wrote probably the first great book about the Rolling Stones, still one of the greatest. And he was he had a remarkable ear for the music of the kind of Memphis R&B scene. And he's just really... brought, I think he's kind of an investigative journalist that's the mode he writes in. There's almost a kind of air of the spy novelist about him, like someone who's investigating a furtive universe.
You mentioned in the introduction that there weren't that many women writing about music initially, so I really didn't expect to find that many pieces in your collection by women, but I was pleasantly surprised. There are a lot of them, and I think one of my favorites, and it kind of scared me when I got to the end of it, was the one written by Ellen Sander. She was working for Life magazine, and she was on tour with Led Zeppelin. It's called Inside the Cages of the Zoo. Whoa, yeah. That just really captures the experience of being on the road with them. Ooh.
Yes, it's an amazing piece, and of course, it's really one of the signature pieces in the anthology. It was a great discovery for us. You know, what? Before I even talk about Sander's piece or about the issue of women in the book, it's worth saying, you know, it's not like we knew all this stuff before we begun our work. We made a lot of discoveries, and we had the help of knowledgeable people throwing us, names and suggestions and, you know, places to look. So Ellen Sander is a great example. That was a name I was barely known to me. I certainly hadn't read her piece on Led Zeppelin before we began organizing this anthology. And we fought to get gender representation up to a kind of respectable level. And it was a fight. And, you know, one of the things that is worth saying about that is that it's not only a righteous cause. Of course it's that. And, you know, I don't want to be polishing my own brass buttons about having done a reasonable job with it, but having an imperative like that pushes you to dig deeper in general. It means that you're trying to take a new look at something that you've taken for granted. So rather than just go with the kind of official canonical names in rock writing, and there are plenty of great writers, and some of them are represented here, and some others, you know, by whatever happenstance, aren't represented here. But it meant that instead of just taking that for a given, we were forced to embrace a kind of, what Keats calls a negative capability. Mm-hmm. Basically, forget what you know. Start over.
Mm-hmm.
Be a beginner. And Ellen Sander, the discovery of this remarkable piece about Led Zeppelin in published in Life magazine is a great example of the result. We could never have known we were looking for this when we set out, but now I think of it as one of the most important pieces in the book. And, you know, it's important in a kind of a two-edged way. It's such a great picture of Led Zeppelin and of the craziness of that moment. But it also is testimony about why more women probably weren't, eager to be in that situation, because they treated her brutally, precisely because she was female, and it was an act of bravery for her to record it, and in many ways may have served as a kind of a warning to women that this wasn't necessarily an easy beat. If you were a journalist.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, a special one-hour edition this Sunday morning. I'll continue my conversation with Jonathan Lethem right after this. Jonathan Lethem joins us, and when I got the book, the first thing I said to myself before I ever opened it was, okay, what are they going to pick by Lester Bangs? And I knew there had to be something by Lester Bangs in here. And the thing you picked, oh, man, I had never read this before. He's brutal.
I'm glad you say that it's unfamiliar to you, because it's a good reminder to me. I'll tell you a story about the journey with Lester Bangs. He was a very important writer to me when I discovered him, when the first anthology of his writings was collected, and his friend and colleague Greil Marcus assembled this terrific giant volume called Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, and it was published by Knopf. At the time, it was a very unusually prestigious, it was a real assertion on the part of the publisher and Greer Marcus's part that this was an important American writer who'd been forgotten. And I drank the Kool-Aid completely. I read it cover to cover. I memorized some of my favorite sequences in it. And by the time it came time to pick a piece for the anthology, you know, I thought of the pieces in that book as all being so obvious that I was a little embarrassed to pick one. And I searched and searched for something unusual, something outre that wasn't in Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, because I thought, oh, everybody knows all those pieces. So you really got to remember sometimes that what you take for granted is not how everyone else is thinking, because that piece is right in the center of that book. And I think it's, you know, it's one of his best pieces of writing. I'm really glad I wasn't afraid of just the obvious, you know, because we circled and circled and then finally circled back to, you know what, that Elvis memorial piece, that's the one. It's got to be the one.
Brilliant stuff. And, oh, he had the sharpest pen. He could just, oh, no respect. Poor Elvis.
Yeah. Well, it's hard. It's hard on Elvis, but it's also a love letter. I mean, you know, I guess I come from this school of, it's partly like a New York City vernacular style. The harder you are on something, the more you probably care about it.
Gotcha. Well, that brings us to, I mean, with Elvis, premature deaths, so many of them, and a lot of these figures written about in these pieces. And one of them, she died so young, was Janis Joplin. And you have a wonderful piece in here by Ellen Willis. And there's a quote in here from Janis where she says, quote, "On stage, I make love to 25,000 people. Then I go home alone."
Yeah. It's a really heartbreaking utterance that reminds you of, the fate of women in the popular imagination. You know, they're revered and can also simultaneously be, they're second class citizens. It's feminism. It's constantly reminding us that some of the loneliest or most oppressed people are also accorded some kind of, you know, glamour or status, and the two things are not, one doesn't make the other untrue. I think of Rita Hayworth, who there's some great line she has. You just reminded me of it with that quote from Janis Joplin, where she says, the problem with my life is when men pursue me, I get to bed with Rita Hayworth, and in the morning they wake up with me. Just heartbreaking.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
I have a hard time picking a favorite, but I think if I did, it would be the one from Hellfire about Jerry Lee Lewis. What a piece this is.
No, well, Nick Tosh's, yeah. Gosh. He's a writer. I would give my arm to write some of the sentences. He's just, yeah, the portrait of, I mean, Tosh is, it makes sense he became a novelist. And, you know, that's his principal writing life after a certain point, is he's written a series of really, really extraordinary novels. And his approach to writing about Jerry Lee Lewis is novelistic. He paints a picture. He sets a scene. And, that's a great piece, too. I'm afraid of picking favorites myself, but that's one I adore.
Well, we've actually had four of the writers that you feature in the book on this program, and another one is Peter Guralnick, and you've got a great one from him, King Solomon, The Throne in Exile.
I do love Peter's work. I've talked with him in public settings a couple of times. We did a panel in New York when his book on Sam Cooke came out, and first of all, what a lovely man. I'm sure you had that experience when he came around, and one of the most, in a way, maybe similar to Stanley Booth, one of the earliest writers to record the lives of, you know, the Memphis and Deep South R&B musicians, and really diligent researcher. He always surrounds it with so much knowledge. You know, it's really, it transcends music writing. It becomes a picture of America when Guralnick writes.
Jonathan Lethem joins us. His book is Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. He and Kevin Detmar edited it for the Library of America. And I guess we'll have to talk about some punks. I've been trying to stick with the old school stuff, but I guess we better. I actually had a personal experience with one of the bands that's in here, so I guess we better talk about Chuck Eddy's essay here on the Ramones. And I encountered them when they were still kind of on top, but this essay sees us looking at the Ramones kind of in decline.
Yeah, yeah, I like that piece for giving that dimension of unsatisfied desire on the part of the writer, you know, wanting the band to have given him more than they were able to give. The Ramones can be kind of heartbreaking. I think in some ways you could almost look at them as a kind of a turning point. They were the first band to be heralded by the traditional rock critics, you know, because the older generation, you know, the first generation, I guess you would say, of the writers for Rolling Stone, recognized mostly, you know, they were able to see that the Ramones represented a kind of a new turning point or a new future for the rock tradition. But it's kind of the first time that acclaim lands on a band, and yet they don't take over the world of, they don't become enormous. They don't have lots and lots of platinum records and play stadiums. They sort of stay underground. And I think it confused the Ramones at a certain point, and it confused their supporters that, now we're accustomed to this. It's the beginning of, I don't know what you'd call it. You know, at one point it was called college rock or the rock underground. It's a time when sounds that might have seemed like they were destined to take over the world didn't exactly.
Uh-huh.
They stayed subcultural. I guess the Velvet Underground are a predecessor for that as well. And then they stuck around and did their thing, and you know, there's some good stuff, but there's nothing in the Ramones to equal their first impact. And I guess that's what Chuck Eddy is laying it on the line in that piece. He's saying, you know, I don't know if these guys still have anything really to say to me.
Back in the early 80s, I was managing a record store in Des Moines, and the Ramones came to town for a show, and they came to the record store to sign their new album. And I stood behind the counter with them, and in our display case, we had a lot of cassette-only releases, a lot of kind of edgy stuff. And while they were signing, they kept peering down at what we had. We had 7 inches in there and various esoteric kind of releases. And after it was all over, they huddled with their manager, and I stood next to them and kind of eavesdropped. And they said, yeah, we want to buy some of this music in here. They said, how much do we have to spend? And the manager kind of mulled it over, and then he finally goes, okay, he goes, you can have $5 each.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
And they pulled their money together and bought 3 cassettes.
You remember what they bought?
No, I don't. But
it'd be great if they'd picked right, if one of those bands, you know, turned out to be REM or something.
No. It was definitely not REM. This is very obscure stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one had some kind of a Nazi theme, if I remember correctly.
Well,
if you can believe it.
I somehow can believe that. Uh-huh. And there's something very tragic about the Ramones after all this time. I mean, partly just the shortness of their lives. You know, who would have thought that we'd have more Beatles still walking the earth than we do Ramones? There's something kind of snake bit about that band.
Yeah, well, we had Marky Ramone on a year or two ago, but I don't really count him.
Yeah. Well, Marky actually speaking of the Beatles, he's kind of like a Ringo figure. Uh-huh. It's like someone once explained that Ringo's job was to be the audience surrogate. He's in the band, but he's also a fan of the band.
Uh-huh. Another favorite, and this is right up there with the one about Jerry Lee, is this bizarre one by Eve Babbitts. Jim Morrison is dead and living in Hollywood. I was crushed.
It's a scalding piece. Yeah. You know, she's a brilliant writer and has recently enjoyed a little bit of a renaissance. Two of her books have been republished by the New York Review of Books editions. And that's after, I think, a long time of her being remembered only by a, you know, very small core of fans, and she's finding new readers again. So it was good timing that we came across this piece, and I do think it's one of the most arresting things in the book. You know, take no prisoners by definition.
Talk about a deep personal connection. She knew him. That's just amazing to read. My guest is Jonathan Lethem. We're talking about Shake It Up. And there are a couple more writers in here who we've had on the show. One we had on for the book that you take an excerpt from, and that is Chuck Klosterman for Fargo Rock City. He's come a long way since then.
Great. Yep. He's made a fascinating kind of unrepeatable career for himself because he's not a music writer. He's as much a sports writer as he is a music writer, but really he's a completely, you know, neither fish nor fowl kind of you know, he makes it up as he goes along, and yet every book is so much, so recognizably a Klosterman project. He's doing really cool stuff. But yeah, you wouldn't have ever known what, you know, I mean, Fargo Rock City is sort of perfect in its way. It just announces itself. And if he'd never written anything again, I think that book would be remembered.
Mm. Another favorite, I love this guy's writing, is Elijah Wald. We had him on for his book, Narco Corridos.
Yeah, I don't know Elijah Wald well, and I came to him again because of the imperatives of the anthology. I was looking for things that I, you know, that I hadn't encountered, and trying to expand my horizon. And so one of the cool things is now I end up with, you would think that my work is done, but actually there's like a lot of stuff that I want to read as a result of having discovered writers in the process of working on the book. And so Elijah Wald is one who I'm looking forward to, you know, spending more time with.
Well, I see we've spent all of our time talking about this new collection, and I've neglected to mention that you've written a lot of other things. You've written novels, you've written different kinds of books, autobiography, short stories, detective type stuff, science fiction type stuff. And some of our readers out there are probably saying to themselves, you know, he should be talking to Jonathan about the connection between this collection and Fortress of Solitude.
Well, that's kind of you. And you know, my novels could get plenty of airtime, so we can leave that for the next conversation. But you know, I did. It is funny when you mention Fortress of Solitude, in that when I wrote that book, what I did was create an autobiographical character who was a rock critic. And I wasn't one at the time. But the result of that, it was almost like a little sleight of hand, by writing about a character who many people identified with me, but awarding him this career as a well-known writer of music criticism and liner notes and so forth, I ended up getting invited into that world. You know, it's sort of like I pole-vaulted my way into this identity. And so I started getting assignments from Rolling Stone, and it was shortly after that that I went and interviewed James Brown and Bob Dylan, and it was really a back formation out of this this novel, because I hadn't been doing that work before. And so in some way there is a lineage out of my, you know, my fiction into this project of you know, identifying enough with the world of music writing to think that I would be the right person to, you know, help create this anthology. So I guess the lesson to fiction writers is, be careful of who you autobiographically write about.
Did you read James McBride's book about James Brown?
Yes, it's terrific.
I love that book.
I really love that book.
I tried to get an interview with him. He's been on the show several times. Could not get one. Hopefully when it comes out in paperback. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking to you, Jonathan.
It's great to talk, and thanks so much for everything you say about the book. I'm really glad you liked it.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, a special one-hour edition for you this Sunday. And don't go away. We have a Book Nook bonus for you coming up in this final segment. We're going to play some of the music that is described in our collection that we just featured with Jonathan Lethem, and also some of the criticism from this collection called Shake It Up, right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, special bonus edition of the Book Nook, an hour for you this Sunday morning. And during my conversation with Jonathan Lethem, I talked about the essay written by Stanley Booth, where he spent time with the late Otis Redding. And I'm going to read you an excerpt from this particular essay and then listen to a little bit of music from Otis Redding. Here we go. Otis is playing a bright red dime store guitar, strumming simple bar chords as he sings, "Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes." The front of the guitar is cracked as if someone has stepped on it. As he sings, Otis watches Steve Cropper, who nods and nods, bending almost double over his guitar, following Otis's chords with a shimmering electric response, "Sitting in the morning sun." "But I don't know why he's sitting," Otis says, rocking back and forth as if he were still singing. "He's just sitting. Got to be more to it than that." He pauses for a moment, shaking his head. Then he says, "Wait. Wait a minute," to Steve, who has been waiting patiently. "I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay." He pauses again, runs through the changes on his fractured guitar, then sings, "I had nothing to live for. Look like nothing's gonna come my way." I write music everywhere, in motels, dressing rooms. I'll just play a song on the guitar and remember it. Then usually I come in the studio and Steve and I work it out. Sometimes I'll have just an idea, maybe for a bass line or some chord changes, maybe just a feeling, and we see what we can make out of it. We try to get everybody to groove together to the way a song feels. When Steve and Otis have the outlines of a song, they are joined by the rest of the MGs. Booker and Duck come in first, followed by drummer Al Jackson. Duck is telling Booker about his new stereo record player. "I got me a nice one, man, with components. You can turn down one of the speakers and hear the words real clear. I've been listening to the Beatles. Last night I played Revolver and On Yellow Submarine. You know what one of them says? I think it's Ringo. He says, 'Paul is a blank.' He really does, man. 'Paul is a blank. Bigger and blank.'" Booker sits at the piano. Duck gets his bass, which has been lying in its case on the worn red rug, and they begin to pick up the chord patterns from Steve and Otis. Al stands by listening, his head tilted to one side. Duck asks him a question about counting the rhythm, and Steve looks up to say, "In a minute he'll want to know what key we're in." Duck sticks out his lower lip. He plays bass as fluently as if it were a guitar, plucking the stout steel strings with his first two fingers, holding a cigarette between the other two. Booker sits erect, his right hand playing short punctuating notes, his left hand resting on his left knee. Otis is standing now, moving around the room, waving his arms as he conducts these men, his friends, who are there to serve him. He looks like a swimmer, moving effortlessly underwater. Then something happens. A connection is made in Al Jackson's mind, and he goes to the drums, baffled on two sides with wallboard. "One, two," he announces. "One, two, four." And for the first time, they are all together. Everyone has found the groove.
In the morning sun, I'll be sitting the evening come, watching the ships roll in, and I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide. Thank you. left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I had nothing to live for. Look like nothing's gonna come my way. So I'm just gonna sit on a dock of the bay, watching the tide. A darker bay, wasting time.
A week later, after Otis Redding had recorded Dock of the Bay, he was dead, killed in a tragic plane crash. We often wondered what kind of music he would have kept making after that. We'll never know, will we? You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was an excerpt I read from Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop, from Elvis to Jay-Z. And during my interview with Jonathan Lethem, we talked about a piece that Nick Toshis wrote about Jerry Lee Lewis. And I'm going to read you an excerpt from that next. It's called Hellfire. The moment he heard it, the very moment he heard himself make that song like he had been trying to make it, and he had been trying to make it something that was fine, not just something that would seem fine coming from an 8-year-old boy with freckles and stuck-out ears, which he knew he was, but something that would seem fine coming from the nickel machine in one of those drunk morning juke joints or from his daddy's Victrola or from a radio. Something that would seem fine coming from any of these and yet had not because it was different. The moment he heard it, he abruptly spun around as if a door had just slammed shut behind him in an empty room, and he looked straight at Uncle Lee Calhoun, who was sitting there in that big chair of his with his pot belly sticking out, looking right straight back at him. And they sat there like that, the two of them, peering at each other from opposite ends of lifelong stubbornness, and they broke into grinning and laughing, each in his own way. The first song that Jerry Lee could play straight through the way he wanted was the 19th century Christmas carol Silent Night. And he played it in a boogie-woogie style. Elmo was so proud of his son that he borrowed money against what worldly possessions he had, and he drove to Monroe, that place of tales, and he purchased a used, stark, upright piano, and he hauled it back down to Faraday in his pickup truck, and he dragged it into his home and set it before Jerry Lee. This was early in 1945. The Mississippi flooded that year, and it was the worst flood since 1927. Downtown Faraday was inundated, and many of the townsfolk had to evacuate their homes and take refuge in a tent camp at the Lake Concordia levee. The war ended that year, too, just a few weeks before Jerry Lee's 10th birthday. As Lee Calhoun had predicted, cotton prices rose to more than 30 cents on the pound during the following year. Now that Jerry Lee had a piano, he attended school even less frequently than he had in the past, and he suffered less at home for his poor grades. Both Elmo and Mamie were confident that their son would be a great music maker, though from the very beginning Mamie hoped and prayed that Jerry Lee would dedicate his talent to the Holy Spirit. In the summer of 1945, Mamie's elder sister Fanny Sue and her family came to visit from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. At the age of 15, Fanny Sue had married a 19-year-old man named John Glasscock, who became a Pentecostal preacher not long after the marriage. They had a 14-year-old son named Carl, who had been born in Epps, Louisiana, on January 3, 1931. Like most preachers' sons, Carl played piano, and this interested his younger cousin Jerry Lee a great deal. Carl told Jerry Lee that he performed regularly at his daddy's church, but once in a while, he leaned a little bit on the boogie, and that made his daddy madder than hell. He sat down at Jerry Lee's stark upright and began to hit some Holy Ghost boogie. And sure enough, his daddy shot him a nasty glance from across the room. They'd bought an old piano, Carl recalled many years later, after he'd become known by a different name, and moved it in that old shotgun house. It was a sort of piano you'd have trouble giving away. I came in there and played the fire out of the thing. Jerry couldn't play too well then. When we left, he came back to Pine Bluff, Arkansas with us for the summer. He stayed with us about a month and a half, and he made me play the piano every day. When he left to go home, he could do everything I could do. He just had that knack. He didn't have those big fingers yet. He couldn't hit those octaves, but he knew the boogie. It was great. Jerry Lee sat at his stark upright every day for hours at a time. He practiced what some people called boogie-woogie and others called the devil's music. Two of his favorites in these early years were Down the Road a Piece, which had been a hit boogie-woogie record in 1940, and House of Blue Lights with Jerry Lee learned from a record of piano player Freddie Slack right after it came out in 1946. He practiced both these songs continuously, and from them, he learned to keep a fast, heavy rhythm going with his left hand while he played melody with his right. The more he practiced, the surer the left hand and the wilder the right hand became. Jerry Lee also practiced Jimmy Rogers songs and Al Jolson songs, which he learned from his parents' records. But these, in Jerry Lee's mind, were more for singing than for the fingers. From the Jimmy Rogers records, Jerry Lee learned a blue yodel. And from the Al Jolson records, he learned the power of vocal audacity. His favorite Jolson record was Down Among the Sheltering Palms. He played old Tin Pan Alley tunes, too, such as In a Shanty in Old Shanty Town, which had been one of the most popular songs of the Depression. But he took a whip to these tunes and shook them down to Boogie Woogie, as he had done with Silent Night. And he always learned the latest Gene Autry songs, such as You're the Only Star in My Blue Heaven, which also became a reconstructed Boogie Woogie song in the hands of young Jerry Lee. In the autumn of 1946, Mamie Lewis became pregnant for the last time. On July 18, 1947, she gave birth to another dark-haired daughter, whom she and Elmo named Linda Gale. By this time, Elmo had installed electrical wiring in his house. For water, however, the Lewises still had to go outside to the well. He purchased a radio from which Jerry Lee absorbed music of every sort. He listened to the popular dance bands that were broadcast by WWL in New Orleans. He listened to the Mississippi Bluesmen, whose records were played on WMIS, right across the river in Natchez. On Saturday nights, he heard the Grand Ole Opry, routed from Nashville by way of WSMB in New Orleans. Whatever he heard, he swallowed it. Then he spat it out on that old stark upright. On the first Saturday night of April 1948, KWKH in Shreveport, the most powerful Louisiana radio station north of New Orleans, introduced a country music program called the Louisiana Hayride, which was patterned after and in competition with the Grand Ole Opry. Jerry Lee was listening to the Hayride one Saturday night the following August when a 24-year-old man from Alabama named Hank Williams made his debut. Hank's voice grabbed Jerry Lee and sent shivers through him, as the Holy Ghost had sent shivers through others he knew. He had already made up his mind that Jimmy Rogers and Al Jolson were the two greatest singers who ever were. Now he placed this new Hank Williams fellow right up there with him. Hank became the most celebrated singer on the Louisiana Hayride, and Jerry Lee listened for him every Saturday night, wondering what he looked like and resolving that he must someday meet him. Occasionally, Hank Williams would get drunk and out of hand. Horace Logan, the man in charge of the program, would fire him. Jerry Lee would listen to the show for Saturday night upon Saturday night, wondering where Hank had gone to. Then always, Hank Williams would return saying, "Howdy, neighbors. It's mighty good to be back." Jerry Lee went to the stark upright and practiced whatever songs he heard Hank sing. The last one of all, the best one of all, he thought, was Lovesick Blues, which Hank first sang on the hayride sometime after Christmas. It was an old song copyrighted in the spring of 1922. The lyrics had been written by Irving Wingrant from Russia, and the music had been composed by a vaudeville pianist named Cliff Friend. The song had been recorded several times in the 20s, and in 1939, it was cut by an Alabama-born country singer named Rex Griffin, from whose record Hank Williams had learned the song. But Hank let everyone believe that the song was his. To Jerry Lee's thinking, it was a perfect song.
I got a feeling called the blues. Oh, Lord, since my baby said goodbye, Lord, I don't know what to do. All I do is sit and sigh. Oh, Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I thought I would cry. She'll do me, she'll do you. She's got the kind of loving, Lord, I love to hear her when she calls me sweet dad. Daddy's such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it's all over. I've lost my heart, it seems. I've grown so used to you somehow. Thought I'm nobody's sugar daddy now. And I'm lonesome. I got the lovesick blues.
closing out the book nook this morning, I have one more excerpt to read from Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. During my interview with Jonathan Lethem, we talked about a piece by Ellen Willis that she wrote about the legendary Janis Joplin. I'm going to close out the program with an excerpt from that essay. Her pursuit of pleasure had the same driven quality. What it amounted to was refusal to admit of any limits that would not finally yield to the virtue of persistence. Try just a little bit harder, and the magic of extremes. This war against limits was largely responsible for the electrifying power of Joplin's early performances. It was what made Cheap Thrills a classic, in spite of unevenness and the impossibility of duplicating on a record the excitement of her concerts. After the split with Big Brother, Janis retrenched considerably, perhaps because she simply couldn't maintain that level of intensity, perhaps for other reasons that would have become clear if she had lived. My uncertainty on this point makes me hesitate to be too dogmatic about my conviction that leaving Big Brother was a mistake. I was a Big Brother fan. I thought they were better musicians than the detractors claimed, but more to the point, technical accomplishment in itself was not something I cared about. I thought it was an ominous sign that so many people did care, including Janis. It was in fact a sign that the tenuous alliance between mass culture and bohemianism, or in my original formulation, the fantasy of stardom and the fantasy of cultural revolution, was breaking down. But the breakdown was not as neat as it might appear, for the elitist concept of good musicianship was as alien to the holistic, egalitarian spirit of rock and roll as the act of leaving one's group the better to pursue one's individual ambition was alien to the holistic, egalitarian pretensions of the cultural revolutionaries. If Joplin's decision to go it alone was influenced by all the obvious professional commercial pressures, it also reflected a conflict of values within the counterculture itself, a conflict that foreshadowed its imminent disintegration. And again, Janis's femaleness complicated the issues, raised the stakes. She had less room to maneuver than a man in her position, fewer alternatives to fall back on if she blew it. If she had to choose between fantasies, it made sense for her to go with stardom, as far as it would take her. Such speculation is, of course, complicated by the fact that Janis died before she really had a chance to define her post-San Francisco, post-Big Brother self. Her last two albums, like her performances with the ill-fated Cosmic Blues Band, had a tentative transitional feel. She was obviously going through important changes. The best evidence of that was Me and Bobby McGee.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. No, no. And feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby. Next to mine. That's all.